It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's conversation, we're going to be talking about the Concord Museum's collaboration with Mass Audubon to present a special exhibition called Alive with Birds, William Brewster in Concord. We're going to explore the life of William Brewster. And he was Mass Audubon's first president, as I understand, and the country's earliest advocates for protection of birds and conservation. And I have with me today two of the people that I would say, curated the exhibition. So I have with me Erica, and Erica Lohm is the curatorial associate at the Concord Museum. Hi, Erica.
Hello.
And I also have Amy Montague, who is at the museum, director of the Museum of American Bird Art at Mass Audubon, which is really, that's also exciting. Welcome, Amy.
Great to meet you, Mark.
Too. So giving our listeners a sense of where the importance of this exhibition is, why is it so important? And so give us a context as you were thinking about curating it, the two of you. What was foremost in your mind about this idea? So
let you take it first as the representative of Mass Audubon.
Well, I was particularly thrilled because I've worked at Mass Audubon for about 30 years. And early on, I happened to find myself in charge of a collection of almost 2,000 glass plate negatives that were taken by William Brewster. And I became fascinated to learn more about him. He was the first president of Mass Audubon, and which was founded in 1896, and he was president for 17 years. And I've learned as much as I had time to learn about him. And it was really exciting to have this opportunity to delve more deeply and to have the collaboration with the Concord Museum and with Erica, who had even more time to delve more deeply. And we learned so much about this man. And I think Erica would agree that every new thing we learned made him even more fascinating. And somebody needs to write this man's biography. So,
right.
Yeah, I'm surprised there isn't one. Erica?
Oh, well, there definitely should be. He's one of these classic, late 19th, early 20th century men of their time who committed themselves to a certain topic and, made it their life's work. And fortunately for all of us, it was to the public's benefit. In this case, William Brewster dedicated his life to the study of birds, and that study evolved into a passionate focus on their nests and eggs and species and the habitats and the landscapes that those birds resided in. And at the Concord Museum, we sort of have a mandate, right? Our exhibitions should tell a story of Concord in some way. And how serendipitous that not only did William Brewster live or have a home in Concord, in addition to his home in Cambridge for 20, 30 years, but also Mass Audubon recently was gifted about 100 acres of what was formerly October Farm, William Brewster's estate in Concord. So the confluence of gift and this Concord story that was dying to be told led us to collaborate with Mass Audubon. And as Amy said, they have all this great archival material. So does Harvard. The Museum of Comparative Zoology has their William Brewster's letters, his journals, a lot more of the ephemera and correspondence. And not only that, they had specimens. They had about 40,000 specimens that William Brewster collected throughout his lifetime, most of which were birds. So the material was there. And I was a curatorial associate, so I was sort of given the responsibility and the privilege to read through as many of the journals as I could to really get a sense of what it was like to be in Concord from about 1890 until his death in 1919. And what did he see? Who did he talk to? And what did he learn? And what can we learn from all that material?
You know, that's really exciting because we know, you know, some of the people, obviously, like Audubon, who were involved with that. But, you know, across the country, we may not know about Webster. So, I mean, this is just kind of one of the really interesting things when I think about how we might build. Why did I say Webster? Sorry, Brewster. But how we might build more understanding of that. And you're right, this is a story that needs to be told. So there was a collection as well as, so was it, did you also have collections of paintings as well? Or so just explain more about Brewster to me, because now I'm really intrigued.
Well, Brewster was very interested in photography. So that resulted in this collection of, as I say, almost 2000 glass plate negatives that he took. Almost certainly many of them with the assistance of Robert Gilbert, who was a Black man who assisted him. And this is one of the things that Erica learned more about, but really seemed to assist him in almost every part of his endeavor, and became he might possibly have been the first African-American to become a member of the American Ornithologists Union. So anyway, we own this collection that specifically relates to Brewster. As Erica said, Harvard, the Museum of Comparative Zoology, owns the big treasure trove of Brewster material. The Museum of American Bird Art is, as one might guess, an art museum. And we have a really extraordinary art collection that kind of spans any genre you can imagine. So, you know, it's, some people think maybe it's just field guide art, but we have Andy Warhol, and we have American Impressionists, and we have, decoys, we have miniature carved birds, and just a wide variety of different kinds of bird art, because as you can imagine, birds really are so present in perhaps more than any other type of wildlife. Birds are present in our daily lives. And so anybody who has an inkling to be creative and put their hand to representing nature in any way is likely to try to represent birds in whatever medium they're working with. So what may seem to some to be a very narrow niche for an art museum turns out to be actually very broad and deep. So it is a very fun thing to be exploring.
So when we were initially planning this exhibition, it was a no-brainer to borrow some of the highlights from Amy's collection and the Museum of Bird Art collection to not only have beautiful works of art on the walls, which of course is, you know, would provide the visitors that pleasure, but to connect those works of art to the Brewster story. And as I'm reading through the journals, I'm starting to see, well, Brewster had something to say about nearly every single bird that's represented in these works of art, whether they were made in the 18th century, 19th century, or works of art that are have been made in the last 10 years. And so it made sense that we shouldn't necessarily interpret the show, we should let Brewster interpret the show. So we have these great works of art accompanied foremost by a passage from Brewster's journals where he's addressing the birds as the subject. And in some cases, we can make more direct connections to what was happening at October Farm. For example, we have a beautiful painting by Frank Weston Benson of the Duck Marsh. It is just a gorgeous work of art, but we can tell the story of the impoundment at Brewster's Woods, which is now what it's called today. It was called October Farm when Brewster lived there. But we can tell this ecological and climate change story too, we can say that in Brewster's age, because of hunting and the fashion for feathers and unregulated hunting seasons, a lot of the waterfowl had declined, especially at October Farm. And so Brewster, by the time he arrives in Concord, his philosophy is evolving, and he understands, he sees the writing on the wall, that because of man, we are losing these precious species of birds. So he puts down the shotgun and sets out to document them in other ways. And one of the sort of projects he does at October Farm is to create this impoundment too. So to create a man-made habitat for waterfowl. And they do come back, and that impoundment is still there today. So we can make that connection between the duck marsh in Benson's painting and the impoundment that you as a visitor could see if you were to visit Brewster's Woods.
Yeah, what I find really exciting is that you're talking about art and science being connected at so many levels here. So from the collection, Amy, that you're talking about of the art, but a lot of that was based on study of things. And sometimes that was the physical collection of, that's why they collected birds and had them so that they could get up close, because obviously birds are moving all the time and it's really difficult if you're an artist to really study it enough to know how to paint in that part. But it, you were also talking, Eric, at another level, and you're talking about climate change and the ecology and that, and the idea that he was looking at, really that idea that, you know, we think of amphibians as being often the first ones to show signs of stress from the environment, but birds are one of those right on the edge of that. So we get that canary in the coal mine idea that, and so he was really seeing, right? He was beginning to see the beginnings of a human impact that early.
Yes. And one of the amazing things about Brewster, he's often referred to as perhaps the first true field ornithologist. Although he grew up in Cambridge, he didn't go to college. He had this passion for birds from, you know, when he was a young boy, a very young boy. In fact, one of his very closest lifetime friends was the sculptor Daniel Chester French. And they birded together throughout their lives. And you know, Erica found some wonderful French material to include in the exhibition. But there are letters between the two of them throughout their lives. Although he never went to college, he had this very analytical academic mind, and he became the first curator of birds at Harvard. And so you can imagine, and he wrote over 300 articles about bird observation. He was meticulous in his daily record keeping of every bird he saw and heard. And when he acquired the property in Concord, it really, I think the only good analogy is he really used it as a biological field station, we would call it today. And I have this suspicion that because he was independently wealthy, which wasn't true of the other top ornithologists of the day, I think that the 300 acres that he owned in Concord may have been the most closely observed for bird life, 300 acres anywhere in the United States. So it's a historic property that miraculously, for 100 years, it was in various private hands, and then was purchased by wonderful neighbors, Nancy Bucus, who purchased the property and gave it to Mass Audubon. So now here's this land that, you know, Brewster thought, you know, was just going to go into private hands and be developed. And the majority of it is now conservation land in perpetuity. So it's a fabulous story to tell. And I have to say, because we're talking about art as well as science here.
That's right.
This is aesthetically a gorgeous property. It's right on the Concord River. The glacial landscape is just filled with, you know, hills and dales and a variety of ecology. And it just, when people come to see it, their response is, it's magical. And I think it's magical in many different dimensions.
Right, he was prescient too, because it was commented in the 1860s, you know, when he was just a boy. I mean, that, you know, the land that he bought up and stitched together to make October Farm, I mean, it could have been condos, it could have been a housing development. That's the same impulse Ralph Waldo Emerson had in purchasing Walden Pond when he did. It's right. The same, we have to protect this landscape. And so Brewster is actually in he's part of this larger tradition in Concord, at least, of land conservation that is spurred on by his contemporaries and his predecessors, including Emerson and of course Thoreau, who contributes to Concord being one of the most documented sites in North America for birds.
Right.
I'm curious about two things. I'll start with one of them. But one is, Amy, you probably know this, but did he journal? Is that how we have all the records? Is that that detail was?
He kept daily journals and diaries. The diaries have like about a paragraph each. They're very brief. The journals sometimes go on page after page of what he saw and what he did, and are, you know, chiefly focused on his bird observations. And as I said, he was known as perhaps the first real field ornithologist versus somebody who sat and, you know, dissected bird specimens and tried to figure out which ones were related to which ones. As the scientists were doing at the time. And he was just passionate about observing. So, you know, we need it all. We need all kinds of people who are interested in learning about our world from every different angle. But this was his, and he threw himself into it with a passion that is just almost unparalleled. And as I said, he was independently wealthy, so he's even able to hire Gilbert, and he had other assistants, Walter Dean, who was primarily a botanist, but who helped him a lot with his ornithology work. These other people that he was able to hire, so that even magnified the prodigious work he did on his own.
So I assume his journals are partly, did he also sketch? Because naturalists would have, he did not.
I
think that's really interesting, because you would have thought so.
He had a very poetic way of writing, but I don't think he was an artist. And it's so funny because French, obviously, it was. And we have in the show some of the sketches and doodles he made in French's ornithological journal.
Oh my goodness.
So it's clear that French and him are you know, these Brattle Street boys are heading up to Fresh Pond, and they are writing down everything. And then French is off in the corner sketching. You know, he's a teenager. My theory is we have one of Brewster's journals or his manuscript for the field guide to birds. And the title page, which is in the show, has absolutely gorgeous calligraphy, and it's different types of fonts. And there are tree branches and little birds spouting from the letters. And I'm like, oh, Brewster did not do that. That's French.
I had the same reaction when I saw it. We don't have any proof of this, but I think there's a lot of evidence.
Yeah, the illumination of the text. Yeah, it might make sense that someone, especially since he didn't have a sketch at all in there, which is really unusual. And we know that, you know, photography wasn't easy to do, very difficult. So, you know, most naturalists at that time, that's why I asked the question, that was a way of being able to record besides text. So he had to make up for that then, obviously. So Brewster was making up for that in his poetic way of description.
Right. And
he was just a beautiful writer. And it's so interesting to see what his literary skills were, knowing that he that his academic career ended at high school. I think that, you know, it's pretty impressive. It speaks impressively of the Cambridge Public Schools of the late 19th century. But his writing, whether it was letters or the journals, is, yeah, as Erica said, truly poetic. And the quotes that she pulled out to, you know, with, for each bird species that's shown in the art that we include, are just beautiful little literary gems, I think.
And I would, now thinking about it, I would argue that his artistic eye can also be seen in the photographs that we have. Because compositionally, and he writes about it in his journals, he did take great pains to stage certain photos of the landscape so that they would be beautiful. And this is where, of course, Gilbert comes into it too. So the two of them are kind of creating, they're staging these shots. And often what that meant was that, you know, Gilbert might have to climb up into a tree to sort of startle the birds out of their nest so that they can be caught mid-flight. But in other cases, they are able to, because of Gilbert's ability and animal handling skills, they are able to navigate quite close-up shots of birds, such as owls, which are notoriously persnickety and do not want to be perceived. So we have some shots that are like, you kind of want to gasp, like, how did you get this close? And then Brewster lays it out into the journal. Well, Gilbert went every single day and fed him food from his own hand. And the bird got to know him and was calm enough to allow us to get this shot. So it's clear that there is a lot of thought that goes into these photographs, which are not just fabulous for us from a historical standpoint, but they do stand alone as works of art. So I think, you know, that's where some of that poetical vision can be spied in the show.
How over what time period was he taking these photographs? Do you guys have a sense?
So I think the earliest ones, I'm not exactly sure the earliest date, but I think there might be some in the late 1880s.
Oh my goodness.
And then almost to his death, which was 1919.
Right.
So
our listeners,
yeah, quite a period of time.
You're right, Amy. Our listeners may not understand that what photography looked like then, right? The equipment, the way of doing that. So what Erica was talking about is really, really doubly amazing, because it was not easy to take a photograph at all.
And not just taking photographs. And of course, you know, it's very hard to do bird photography because you know, we didn't have any long distance lenses in those days. So you put a glass that had a photographic emulsion on it into the camera and you just expose that for a certain period of time, but you couldn't, you know, you got whatever the camera was pointed at, basically. You know, you couldn't manipulate the focal point of the lens. So the other thing that's really fascinating is that, they weren't only just interested in capturing these and then having them developed, you know, eons later, but they would go in the summertime, they'd go up to Lake Umbagog on the Maine, New Hampshire border, sometimes for many weeks at a time. And there's this one photograph that is of the dark room at Lake Umbagog. Erica, would you like to describe what the dark room looks
like? Yeah, what was it?
Almost like a hollowed out tree that with a door that is covered in leaves. And it's like
it's outside?
Yeah.
It's, oh my gosh.
It's like a little hut that's sort of at the base of this tree or inside the tree. And that's where they would develop the photos. It's amazing.
That's just an incredible story all on its own.
Right.
Do you have any of the plates were any of them surviving that you used in the exhibit? Any of the glass plates?
Did we include them in the exhibit?
Yeah, did any survive? And then did you include any in the exhibit?
That's what Mass Audubon owns. We own almost 2,000 of these glass plates.
Oh my goodness.
And Harvard, and we have a few photographic prints. Harvard has a lot of prints, and they may have a few of the plates, but you know, one of our dreams is to actually kind of integrate the two collections so that we know, you know, where there are both plates and prints that came from the same origin, or they may have prints that we don't have plates for. We may have plates that we don't have prints for. They may have prints that have captions on the back and we've lost captions, so that it would be great to be able to pull those together and then, you know, curate it online for the public to enjoy. We just need a huge
volunteer corps to help.
We have several exhibition graphics based on those plates, but what we decided to do was we teamed up with a Boston-based design firm, Richard Lewis Media Group, who we've worked with in the past, and we basically said we want to take these black and white photos and do something with them, you know, make them come alive somehow. And I think the little light bulb went off in their heads. And so what they did over the course of about 7 or 8 months was they filmed at Brewster's Woods as it is today. And I think the technique is called match framing or frame matching, where they will take the black and white photos and then we have this beautiful four screen media element in the gallery, and you can watch as it unfolds over seasons and weather as the black and white photos transform into the modern day landscape of Brewster's Woods. And you'll find that not much has changed at all. A lot of the landscape has really been remarkably intact. That way we can take Brewster's words and the photos and bring them into the present day. And so visitors hopefully come away excited and they gotta go see it. They gotta go visit.
Yeah, and that was the second kind of thought I had about was, so this acreage that Brewster was able to have, and again, you mentioned Amy because he was able to not have to worry about finance as much as others, that gave him this, really, this kind of, and it was huge. So it gave him this really laboratory that allowed him to develop techniques of not only as we were talking about with the photography, but it allowed him to see, which I think is really unusual as we know about the study of birds, to see them in their actual movement and record that. You know, often the ones like you were talking about that do it from a study collection, they sometimes didn't get right what the displays were, for instance, a mating or the other, you know, because they only saw it with the wings down. They didn't, you know, they didn't see it doing the behavior. And so he had, you know, that is an amazing coupling of seeing behavior and description along with photos and paintings.
And he's working out things like bird songs in the journals. You can see he sort of is writing out, like, you know, he'll have these sort of staccato phonetic translations of what he's hearing, and you know, Gilbert will do the same in his notes and his letters. And I think he also develops this passion for nests and eggs, which really was not at the time what people were interested in, and that really can only be done in situ. So he is able to observe things that, you know, were not even on the radar of his contemporaries. And, you know, that it is interesting. We do have one sort of connection to an artist in the show, Genevieve Jones, who she in the 1870s embarked on a Audubon-esque project to document the nests and eggs of the birds. So she's an artist and she sends some of the plates to Brewster. You know, she kind of just out of the blue sends them to her, and he's kind enough to respond and offer his critique, which is fair. And I think he says they are in its kind of perfect masterpiece, something to that effect. You know, he's generous with his praise, but he also says, I'm so happy to find someone as interested in this subject as I am, nests and eggs. You know, I think that's really delighted him. And I think it goes to the broader point we make in the show that he was, I think, incredibly generous with his time and his attention, especially in elevating and amplifying people around him who would not normally in the late 19th century have that sort of platform.
That's great.
I think that ahead, just to Amy. Add to that, we said that he was the first president of Massachusetts, but Also, he was a founder, I think, when he was still a teenager, of what was the first bird club in the country. It still exists. It's the Nuttall Ornithological Club. It started out meeting in Brewster's home, and Daniel Chester French was one of the members. But then he also got together when he was, a more mature ornithologist, and with several others, founded the American Ornithologists Union, which I think is now called the Ornithological Society. And I think it's the largest professional ornithological group in the world, I believe, at least in North America. So this interest in, as Erica said, encouraging other people and bringing like-minded people together in a meaningful way was really part of what drove him. I also wanted to say that, you know, it fascinates me that even though when he bought the property in Concord, there was an antique farmhouse that was a part of that property, and he sometimes stayed there, but before long he built a cabin right on the Concord River, because that's where he wanted to stay unless the weather wouldn't allow him to. And whenever he went to Concord, he stayed there, and he said that he wanted to sleep there at night so he could wake up being surrounded by the bird song right by the river.
Oh my goodness.
And he also had a sailing canoe, and he built a quite elaborate stone shed for the sailing canoe that is still there along the river. So he just wanted to be completely embedded in the world that the birds lived in, and to record all of that.
I think another point that we try to make in this show is, my assumption coming into this is that ornithology and bird observation is a very solitary, isolated activity, but Brewster disproves that point, that it was a communal social activity. The guest logs to October Farm show that it was like a revolving door of guests, and not only his friends, but Concord neighbors. We see the Emersons stopping by. They must have been so curious, what's this guy doing off in the woods? And it really shows that he is building a community here. And then of course that extends to what Mass Audubon is doing. And that organization begins from the two women who founded it, Minna Hall and Harriet Hemingway, who recruited Brewster to be its president. And that came at such a, that was 1896, it came at such a transformational time in Brewster's own life, where he's now 5 or 6 years into this Concord experiment. And he's actually seeing the fruits of his labor in no longer acquiring specimens to study, but really observing birds in their habitat and describing their behaviors. So it kind of all culminated in this position at Mass Audubon, where he could now be he could now affect real change on a state and federal level.
This is wonderful. I've been talking with Erica Lum, the curatorial assistant at the Concord Museum, and Amy Montague, who's the museum director of the Museum of American Bird Art at Mass Audubon. And we've been talking about William Brewster, and really an amazing character. And we'll talk more about it after this break.
This is Dave Bagdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling. We're having a conversation about the life of William Brewster and his contributions with birds, and really this whole idea of conservation. But I wanted, Amy, to return to something that I think is very important. And it is not a small thing that he was the first president of the Mass Audubon. And I think it's important that we let visitors know, I mean, to our show, that you were not only the first, but it's not affiliated with the National Audubon Society. So I think that's interesting. Can you describe more about that?
Sure. Mass Audubon was founded in 1896. And as Erica mentioned earlier, it was founded by two women who were cousins, Harriet Hemingway and Minna Hall. And the motivation for them to found what was the first Audubon Society really was that they were just appalled by the slaughter of birds for fashion, especially in women's hats. And they brought together other high society women in Boston, and they, you know, signed pledges that they weren't going to wear feather apparel, and they recruited William Brewster to be the first president. And then, you know, this concept spread, you know, relatively quickly. Mass Audubon helped other states form Audubon societies, and many of those joined together to become National Audubon. But Massachusetts Audubon was extremely successful by this time and throughout Massachusetts, and is a very strong national and, you know, internationally recognized conservation organization. And we've remained independent throughout. So I know you have a broad audience, Mark, that is certainly beyond the Massachusetts. So not everybody may be aware, and often people get, you know, confused about just the term Audubon Society. So
I do, just because of the same name. You know,
absolutely.
How did the two women know Brewster? What was their
connection? I have to say, you know, Boston society was not that large in those days. The wealthiest of the Boston Brahmins. And there was, of course, deep intersection between the wealthy Boston society people and Harvard scholars, of which, you know, Brewster by then was certainly one. So, and I'm sure that he was known as the Birdman in the Boston area. So, because he was certainly known beyond Boston as the Birdman. So, right. So I think it was a natural thing, but it's a wonderful thing that here's this man who really what he wants to be doing all day, every day is just being outdoors watching birds. And he was willing to take this mantle on him and perform this duty for 17 years. So really at the infancy of the conservation movement. So proud of that legacy.
You should be. And then Erica, it kind of fits then and very fitting that what you're trying to portray in here was not only the art and the science that was in there, but this kind of a legacy of conservation too, so how are you doing that in an exhibit?
Well, we have about, I think, 1,000 square feet of space to work with, so we are limited physically, so we had to figure out what is the most essential story to tell, and of course we need to introduce you to William Brewster. We do that with a beautiful pastel portrait made by who else but Daniel Chester French. And the chair, the rustic style chair that he had in his cabin by the Concord River. And of course, you know, you look at it and you think, God, he must have whittled this himself. But no, he, of course, bought it from an outfitter, as all, you know, country gentlemen did. but, you know, we knew that the important stories to tell was this evolution in his approach to ornithology. And tied to that was his becoming the first president of Mass Audubon. These stories kind of go hand in hand. And it's interesting because as we lay it out, we have his journal open to an entry in 1886, and he's in Concord. And in 1886, he writes, I saw and heard 12 golden winged warblers, and I shot 6 of them. And we have a little specimen right next to it of one of his little golden winged warblers. And then a beautiful quote above that case, dated 1890. So 4 years later, I left the shotgun at home today and I did not once regret it. So within a few years, he's completely changed his tune. And so that's an important story we wanted to tell. Of course, we also wanted to tell the story of his relationship to Daniel Chester French, this relationship that is so meaningful to both of them, not only socially, but you know, an interest in ornithology influenced Daniel Chester French's art. And we have a piece of sculpture, a winged dove, based on a pair of bird's wings that Brewster gave him as a youth. We wanted to tell the story of Brewster's circle and touching on those relationships I mentioned between Genevieve Jones and, of course, Robert Gilbert, who gets his own shout out. And more than that, we wanted the art to kind of help carry these messages. So as we discussed in the first part of this conversation, he helps to interpret the works of art, and the works of art also help to make points that over time, certain bird populations have declined. So birds that were common in Brewster's day are no longer so common today, like the golden-winged warbler. But vice versa, we have David Sibley's wild turkey illustration. And Brewster is writing in 1902 that they're extinct. We don't have wild turkeys in Massachusetts anymore. And now, of course, today, you can't turn a corner without tripping over a turkey. Massachusetts. And that's because in the 50s and 60s, wildlife biologists began reintroducing the population to the Northeast. And now we have over 30,000 wild turkeys in Massachusetts. So we can carry those messages using the art while also centering Brewster's words and letting you appreciate the works of art by themselves. So as is the sort of philosophy of the Concord Museum, we put the objects to work for us. And I think they pay rich dividends in that you can come as a visitor purely to appreciate works of art and come away with new information about Brewster and the history of Mass Audubon. Or you could come in as a scientist or a lover of birds and take away, I think, an added dimension of appreciation for birds through the words and works of art that you encounter in these galleries. So we do a lot with a little, but it really goes a long way.
So Erica, when you flow through the exhibit, is it sort of like you can explore it in different ways on your own, or are you curatorially trying to direct them through?
Well, we are sort of packing a lot of the historical information in the first gallery. So you can spend a lot of time in that first gallery reading every label, appreciating works of art, understanding the artifacts. And then in the second gallery, we allow the media element to really have space to breathe. So you can, after absorbing all of this information, you go into the next gallery and have a seat and experience 10 minutes of beautiful landscape filmography guided by Brewster's own words. And I think the coda of the show, which is, you know, very bittersweet in my mind, makes me sad just thinking about it. So the coda of the show is this watercolor painting by Lars Johnson of the Concord River. And it's accompanied by Brewster's last journal entry in Concord. He writes it in May 1919. And he is just so in love with where he is, the bird song, the summer, summer's approaching, it's in the air, he takes the train or the car back to Cambridge, and he dies a few weeks later. And his best friend, Daniel Chester French, who's annotating a selection of these journal entries when they're published in the 1930s, he says this was his last entry before he died. So it's, I think, fitting that the show ends where Brewster's journals end. In Concord, feeling as happy as he is to be surrounded by birdsong.
And he probably had no real idea, Amy, did he, that this would really continue as it has. He did the best I think he could to set it up in a way that, you know, the land would have been preserved. But it was really also happenstance that it moved through a bunch of families who had no other intention with it either.
It is a miracle that every time I think about it, Mark, I get goosebumps. And when after he died, you know, because he was such a luminary presence for the American Ornithologists Union, there was a 30-page memorial piece published in their journal and written by one of his Harvard friends. And there's this paragraph. I think we still have time and I can read it because this truly gives me goosebumps. This paragraph says, Brewster greatly regretted that all interest in his conquered place was destined to lapse when he was through with it. And he frequently debated some possible use it might be put to. At one time, he thought of offering it to the town of Concord, but deemed that its remoteness from the town center would militate against its usefulness as a local park. He also discussed its availability for a duck and game breeding place or for a bird refuge. Its availability for any of these uses, for one reason or another, seemed questionable. And finally, in despair of finding a promising scheme, he dropped consideration of it. And it was sold when he died, and it was broken up into smaller pieces. A woman who bought the property in the 1980s started reassembling pieces when they came. And then, you know, wonderful Nancy Bucus made this purchase 2 years ago of the property to give to Mass Audubon. And now not only is this, you know, 140 acres, you know, in Mass Audubon's hands as conservation land, but across the river is Great Meadows National Wildlife Refuge. There is town and land conservation trust land that was also Brewster's that abuts it. So it's something like 2,000 acres of protected land that's all in one area now, and much of that, you know, a significant amount of Brewster's original land. So it is almost miraculous when you think that after 100 years in private hands, the Brewster's Woods property is now protected.
Yeah, that's incredible. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations like we're having today. And we would encourage you to have these conversations about what we've been talking about among your family and community at home, and we'll be right back.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and we're having a conversation with Erica Loam and Amy Montague about really this exciting new, I guess what I would call exhibition, but it's not new in terms of the excitement of the art and science connections with Brewster. And but you started early on and a couple times reminded me about the importance of the community that was built around you. And I feel amazed that there were all these individuals from the community that came, that, as you had mentioned, Amy, one of the very first African-American ornithology studying that, but going further. And I'm just curious, what do you all feel that was his gift in being able to build this community? It's amazing.
Well, I'll be interested to know what Erica thinks about this, but just to think about all the different layers and how he, you know, there was the Harvard community, there was the American Ornithologists Union, so this broad community of people across the country, and then the people that she was talking about in Concord. You know, he's almost every second or third day he's traveling somewhere to meet with somebody. And, you know, it's just fascinating to me to imagine this man who, on the one hand, wants to be, you know, in a quiet place listening to and observing birds. And on the other hand, he is experiencing community at all these different levels and pulling them all together for the benefit of the future of birds and conservation. What do you think, Erica?
It's so funny, you know, when you read the eulogies about him, and especially when you read Daniel Chester French's introduction to October Farm, which is the published selection of journal entries, it's hard to exaggerate how beloved he was. And it seems as though he was one of these people that just, he understood, he listened, and people wanted to be around him. And I can't help but read just a few lines from this introduction.
Yeah, please.
I think give you a sense of what French thought about him. It is difficult to depict the peculiar charm of William Brewster's personality. His good looks were a part of it, but others are as well endowed. It was not that he was a fine gentleman, he was more than that, or that he was interesting in discourse, which he was. It was perhaps a combination of these with a certain simplicity and unworldliness, an unspoiled quality that is rare in one as much a part of the world as he was, but also a certain sincerity and rightness of soul that were evident to all who knew him. And this isn't an isolated quotation. Everyone who wrote about him, oh my God, he's the nicest guy, so handsome, so wonderful, so smart, so charming. It just seems like he was a magnetic figure, one of these just classic men of their time that really inspires you. And, you know, I'm sure he was very much a man of his time in other ways that we can fairly critique. But from what we've read and what we've researched about him, he really does lend himself to this reading of someone who had a larger vision of what this field could be. And that extended to the work he did as Mass Audubon's first president in commissioning works of art to go into people's homes, right? He commissions Luis Agassiz Fuertes, who we have one of his posters in the show, designed to introduce American families to common birds. So he wanted his community to be a global community of bird lovers. And that's evident in his smaller circle, but also the wide reach he had long after he died.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. And Erica, you mentioned Man of His Times and the idea, but he really, this idea of community was really big because he really was trying to move it beyond high society only, as that certainly was helpful for him because, you know, that gave him connections to money and things to be able to do certain things. But the honest truth, I think, is he was really doing like many of us in nonprofits do, which is to be able to move that message to as common a person as we could get.
Yes. And that certainly is what, you know, what was motivating, you know, the founders of Mass Audubon in trying to spread the word and get as many members as possible to be lobbying for laws that would restrict the killing of birds, you know, right. Not only for, you know, eventually for feather apparel, but market gunning for shorebirds that were being, you know, killed to be shipped to restaurants for, you know, wealthy people to eat. You know, all of the different ways that that bird life was really being decimated at the time. So, Mass Audubon, you know, was the initiator of the original legislation to protect birds. So, it's a great heritage, and he was absolutely, you know, an integral part of it.
Erica and Amy, when you think about curating it, I'm thinking about, because of my own museum background, all of the objects that you could choose from. How do you, as curators, go about selecting through thousands of objects?
Boy.
What's the title of that one?
I think when it came to working more specifically with the fine art, it was, you know, I think we had certain criteria, right? We wanted them to be superb examples of the form, which the Museum of Bird Art does have. But we also, you know, we're reading his journals alongside, you know, looking at these works of art. And the selection ended up, there really, we didn't have any arguments because it was clear that the best examples we have are also the best examples of interpreting his journals as well. So, you know, we knew we could put about 20 works of art in the show that could really give you a sense of his writings, not just on songbirds and waterfowl, but also represent across different media. We have watercolors, paintings, we have works of sculpture, we have linotypes as well. We have a lot of different examples to represent the diversity of artists who chose birds as their subject. We also knew from organizing the show that we had these little chapters of his life. We had the French chapter, we had the October Farm Ornithology Experiment chapter, we had the Robert Gilbert chapter. And so we always want, and this is another philosophy we have at the Concord Museum, we always want to let the object help tell the story. So we don't want to put a story on the wall that we cannot have an object for, because I think visitors don't necessarily want to read a textbook on the wall. You know, their way into the story should be material. So we were careful in selecting stories that had objects and objects that we could tell stories with. So it all came together quite perfectly in that regard.
Amy, anything on that from you? How did you wade through all that?
Well, I think Erica described it really perfectly. And we did, you know, we had conversations, but they were pretty quick, and there was a lot of agreement with what was the best way to tell those stories and the most effective objects to show. In terms of the art, you know, we really wanted a variety of bird species, as well as the wonderful connections to his quotes. So, but we were able to do that. It really fell into place beautifully.
This is such a wonderful exhibit. Erica, I wanted to ask you, will there be an exhibition catalog or anything with this exhibit that goes along with it so people could see it? Or
I only hope that the story can go on. So, you know, okay. Amy, let's talk.
Okay, because, you know, I think there's a lot of people that, you know, you think, first of all, it might be only in Massachusetts, but I think a lot of people, because of the love of birds and this connection to that, and that Brewster really was a scientist also in his own right. And I think all those connections, and then a poet, which is an artist, was really great. I want to thank both of my guests, Erica Loam and Amy Montague. And I'm almost out of breath because it's just an incredible experience to have talked to you about what you've been able to do. And thank you so much. Until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again as we explore more connections between the worlds of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.